rather, that SpaceX launched a while back, and that's the one that's it's not in the same orbit that Kepler's following the Earth in a heliocentric orbit. Tesla's doing that. Tesla's going out to around the location of where the moon would be, but they time it where the moon is nowhere near that location. That the moon is like 90 degrees in front of it, and then it orbits, I think, 13.8 days, or roughly 14 days. Every 14 days, it's coming back to the same location in the sky out near the moon, but each time it does that, because the moon takes 30 days to go around the sun, around the Earth, Tesla's never near the moon itself. That's why it stays in a very stable orbit, and they expect it to last 10 years or more. And that has four CCD cameras, charge couple device cameras, staring out at the sky, looking at all these usually nearby suns. You know, they're not looking at necessarily at something at 8,000 light years away like Kepler's doing. They're looking for nearby suns or stars that have planets going around it, and once they do a count on that, they'll be able to turn that information over to James Propulsion Laboratory and let the James Webb Space Telescope, once it's launched in 2021, to follow up on test discoveries and to see if these planets have atmospheres, oxygen, methane, clouds, water. So they think James Webb will be able to do that. So that's pretty good. I was talking about Wallops Island launching Antares rocket, the Cygnus on top. That facility at Wallops has now taken on another contract by Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab has their own rocket called the Electron rocket that they've developed for small payloads, you know, 300-500 pound payloads that they could put into low Earth orbit. The Electron rocket, not that, you know, nothing to do with, you know, physics or electrons, but they call it that because the pumps that run the fuel that's running RP-1, which is our rocket propellant one, which is really kerosene and liquid oxygen. Those pumps that are running are being, you know, they're normally being driven by a usually by gas or even steam, pushing these pumps up to 100,000 RPM to get all this fuel into the rocket. The Electron isn't done like that. It's done with electric motors and batteries. And each one has its own battery and electric motor. Each one puts out like 50 horsepower to run pumps, and it runs 9 different engines. So it's been successfully, had two successful launches so far. And when I say he, I mean his name is Peter Beck. He owns Rocket Lab. They're really an American company. He's licensed in California. He's building these rockets right now, the engines themselves in California. And they're called Rutherford engines. They're all assembled in New Zealand. Why New Zealand? Because he built his own launch facility in New Zealand. And they call it the North Island, two big islands. New Zealand, he wanted to launch from the South Island, but New Zealand said, no way, it's populated over here. So it's a beautiful launch facility. It's high bluff. That's where he's got a launch pad. He plans on launching like, you know, one launch every 2 weeks. So he would like to launch 50 what are they called, Electron rockets every year. So that's his goal. But at the same time, he needed another location for different inclinations. Shows while it's silent, the place that launched Atari's rocket in Virginia. And now, right now, they are building a launch facility for Rocket Lab to launch their Electron rockets from Virginia, not too far away from here. I don't know if they're going to be bright enough for us to see them, but it's pretty cool. As far as I'm concerned, Virginia's not all that far away. It's not Florida, that's for sure. And they plan on launching roughly once a month eventually once they get going. The first launch won't be until the fall of next year from Virginia. So I'm looking forward to that. Let me drop it. Okay, other countries are still launching rockets left and right. Japan just launched another H-2A rocket with the satellites that they need themselves. That's not the H-2B. It's two main rockets they launched in Japan, the H-2A and the H-2B. They're specifically not designed to launch the H-2B cargo vehicle to the International Space Station. But the H-2A is the ones that they launch with for themselves or for other paying companies or countries who want to put satellites in space. But they're still launching their vehicles. They just did that successfully a couple of weeks ago. One other thing, the Starlink update I wanted to mention. Starlink are satellites being built by SpaceX, and the idea of Starlink is to create thousands of satellites which will eventually become its own space internet. You know, you'd be able to sign up with SpaceX instead of Verizon or Optimum. You'd be able to sign up with SpaceX and put an antenna on your roof, link up to the satellites, and be on the internet. My guess, TV and everything will be on these things. Well, he's building them in Washington State. He's got a factory set up, so he's building one satellite after the other. He's got some slowdowns over there. He's laying people off, and I guess he's going to hire new people to try to increase the productivity of these things. I don't know if he thinks he's making Tesla cars or what, but he's building satellites, and takes a lot of work and time. That's his goal, to try to start launching these things by next year. Hopefully within 4 years or so from now, you have enough satellites up to bring the space internet online with Starlink. Coming up in a couple of weeks, we have Thanksgiving, but soon, right after Thanksgiving, we have the InSight landing on Mars. It was originally scheduled to be the day after Thanksgiving, but now it's that Monday after Thanksgiving. So it'll be a landing at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Unless you're off or retired, you might not be able to see that. You'll have to look for it on the internet, and NASA will have replays of it, of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory involved with landing the InSight lander on Mars. So that should be pretty good. They'll talk about the EDL. EDL is entry, descent, and landing. They'll talk about what's involved with doing that. Maybe I can get more details out of it. But, it's a roughly a 900-pound vehicle that you need to separate from the cruise stage. Around 70 miles high, that'll happen. And then space rifle. Point the T-shield not straight down. It's going to go like on a 12-degree angle. It's going to skim through the atmosphere. If it went too much of an angle, it would heat up and burn up. So these things get up to like 1,000 degrees centigrade. Enough to make melt steel. It's real careful. Hope it comes in at the right angle. They've done this type of thing, of course, many, many times before. This one is a little bit heavier than the mission that they did back in 2007. Insight is almost a direct copy, it looks like, the Phoenix mission, but again, it's heavier. It's also landing at a higher altitude than it has less atmosphere to travel through, which means they needed a bigger, stronger parachute, and they hope this 40-foot diameter parachute opens up properly at 1,000 miles per hour. They call them supersonic parachutes. So, see how the Insight does. It's got these pyrotechnic devices that have fired, there's six of them that are going to fire to separate the heat shield, and that will expose the landing legs. The landing legs will be able to pop open. They have pyrotechnics on it to do that, and they're spring loaded. They'll pop open. There's three landing legs. At that point, the radar will turn on. Insight will separate from the back shell. That means the parachute disappears, and Insight will be on its own. It has its own thrusters. That's 12 thrusters that'll light up, and the pulse thrusters that'll adjust the thrust on every one of these thrusters, and hopefully they'll come to a landing. We'll see what happens. They have to actually shut the thrusters off on time. Just as it lands, otherwise the whole thing will flip over. And once that's on the ground, they'll be able to start putting their equipment onto the planet. They have the seismometer, they have the heat flow experiment, and a robotic arm that will do that. Cameras on board, which will check out the area all around them. If you don't need any rocks, they plan on landing in a very quiet area. On a news conference, they said the area they're shooting for is as flat as a Walmart parking lot, and they don't need to look at rocks. They want to see what's inside the planet, and they have this seismometer, which has six seismometers inside, and that's part of the way that they can tell direction from where any Mars quakes occur. They have the heat flow experiment that's going to dig itself or pound itself into the ground, 15 feet into the ground, to check the temperature of the inside of Mars. And hopefully that will go well. The interesting thing was with the radar as it comes down. The radar has these, eight antennas. They call them patch antennas. Dick, you probably know what that is. Like they look like little square antennas on the very bottom of the lander. So as it's coming down, you'll have four transmitting antennas and four receiving antennas, patch antennas, all working at the same time. And you'll have one looking straight down, so it will be able to tell the exact altitude. The other three antennas will be looking out on an angle. I think they said like 30 degrees out on an angle, so if you look on the ground, and that gives you four transmitters, one looking straight down and three looking at different angles as it's coming down, and then you have, each one has its own receiving antenna, and they did that. I thought what they would normally do is, in the past, is they switch back and forth, less antennas, less. Push back and forth. They don't want to do that. They want constant transmitting and receiving. So that's what these things will be doing. They're right on top of each other, on the bottom of the lander. How they're not going to interfere with one another, all I can picture is these gigantic circulators in there, or little circulators in there. Why they're not going to interfere with each other. Not sure of the frequencies, pretty interesting. Maybe you have comments on that, Dick, or about patch antennas that they use for the Insight Mars lander. This is WS20.
See, I got lots of words on patch antennas. Stand by. We all know what a dipole would look like in free space. And if you want to, you could make your dipole out of strips of copper tape, for instance. The next question would be, how wide could I make the copper tape? Well, you could make the copper tape as wide as the antenna is long so that it becomes a square. And you don't have to have an insulator in the middle. You could take a piece of copper tape that's a half wavelength long with no insulator in the middle. It's just one continuous piece of copper. And by way of a gamma match, a T match, a delta match, there's various ways you can feed signal into that dipole-like structure, that piece of sheet metal. And as I said, the sheet metal could be as wide as it is long. It could become a square or a rectangle. That's an efficient dipole-like antenna. Works like a charm. As you now bring it down to a very large ground plane, common sense would lead you to believe that the nearby piece of sheet metal is going to short out the dipole. It's not going to continue to keep working. Let me drop this. It's got the right kind of a sheet of insulating material in between the dipole and the sheet of metal. It'll keep right on working. As you build the, and you call it a patch antenna, as you take your patch antenna and make the spacing to the ground plane smaller and smaller, the Q goes up. The antenna becomes more and more narrowband. But because it's such a wide sheet of metal with such a low internal resistivity, it keeps all of its efficiency, just that it becomes very narrowband. Because they become narrowband, as long as you're operating them on different frequencies, you could have them side by side, and they wouldn't couple to each other. It's a little bit hard to picture how a patch antenna continues to radiate like a dipole when it's up against something you and I would consider a short circuit, a great big sheet of metal, or the side of a rocket. Let me drop. The dipole still gives you a voltage rise at resonance, a great big voltage rise at resonance because of tie and Q becoming narrow in bandwidth. The right-hand side develops a great big positive voltage, the left-hand side a great big negative voltage at this half cycle. And what you think is a dipole now becomes a pair of dipoles, because when it's against the great big sheet of metal, you get a voltage gap in between that the right-hand side of the dipole was positive, the nearby sheet metal, by comparison, will be negative. So you get this high E-field voltage between the right-hand side and the nearby sheet metal, and the great big negative voltage of the left-hand side of the dipole/patch versus the sheet metal. So the patch antenna really becomes a phased array of two local dipoles out at the edge of the patch. It appears to do all of its radiating out at the edge. And as I said, it's a high Q resonator. So as long as you've got different frequencies on the two patches, one transmitting and one receiving, you could operate them side by side. Even if they're on the exact same frequency, they don't couple very well to each other. The patch antenna does its maximum radiation broadside to the sheet of metal it's mounted against. So two patches side by side have an amazingly small amount of coupling between the two. One could be doing transmitting and one could be doing receiving. With a little bit of a nulling circuit, you can keep the transmitter from jamming your own receiver. Let me drop. So patch antennas, even though they're opposite of common sense, work very well. If you take the latest issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, of the, it's 50 or so chapters in there, one of those chapters is devoted to patch antennas, and that chapter got considerably expanded in the latest edition, the fourth edition by Volactus. But they give you the formulas, they give you the diagrams, they show you how you feed it. In the case of a patch antenna, quite often it's very easy to feed it. You poke a wire through the ground plane and touch the patch antenna in just the right spot and mount a connector there. And so you can feed it with one little post that goes through the ground plane and touches the patch antenna. That's one of many ways you can feed a patch. So there were smart people using patch antennas as a feed horn for parabolic dish antennas, and they work very well. So those are a few words on patch antennas. And if we got a little bit of time left over at the end, I'd like you to give us a few words on the planets. I got a specific question about the planets that Kepler and Tess and Gaia are discovering. But over to you, Patch. WS2N, K2RIW, Grand Pole.
Okay, very good. And I said, okay, on Kepler. Now Tess is taking over. But yeah, Gaia does the same thing too. Don't know as much about that mission. I used to, but I haven't been following that one lately. That was by European Space Agency. By the way, I sent you a picture of the bottom of the three-legged InSight vehicle. You can see the bottom. You can see the eight patches that are sitting there. Now you got to remember the diameter of the whole vehicle. I think it's around 7 feet. When they open up the solar arrays, they're round circular solar arrays. I believe they're 12 feet in diameter, a little bit less. Two of them. So that'll give you a good idea of what you're looking at. I sent Roy one as well. I don't know if he wants to put that on his website, but he could. They had a patch antenna. That's what's going to determine whether or not the InSight mission makes it down to Mars, probably. Drop. Another mission that is now officially over, launched in 2007, I believe it was, is the Dawn mission. Dawn mission, very, very successful. It flew out to, originally, Vesta, the asteroid Vesta. It was around 300 miles in diameter. Went into orbit around it and spent, I think, a year and a half or longer in Vesta. Studying that. So successfully orbited it, but it was the first vehicle to actually deorbit from any celestial body and go to another one. It went to Sirius. Sirius is a bigger asteroid, about twice that size, around 600 miles in diameter. It took about a year or so to get to Sirius, and then went into orbit around that, and has been in orbit ever since, taking closer and closer pictures as time went on. They dropped the altitude on Dawn. Got plenty of good pictures, but eventually it started to run out of fuel. It too had gyro problems, so they were using a lot of fuel to keep it oriented properly, keep the antenna pointing to us, keep the cameras looking down. But eventually that's not going to last forever. But they got plenty of use out of the Dawn spacecraft. This is the one that had three ion engines on board. It wasn't, a proof of concept mission. Was meant to use these ion engines. The proof of concept mission was Deep Space One, and that had just a one ion engine. Since that was very successful, when they built Dawn, they did this. Since then, dozens and dozens of spacecraft that have gone up, including the ones that geosynchronous orbit, have ion engines similar to this, where they're able to maneuver in the geosynchronous mode. They can move one location to another just by firing these very small thrust engines. And the trick is they could leave them on forever. Dawn, when it was going up to the asteroid belt, never shut them off. They would fire like years at a time. They had three on board, and it was set at, I think it was 30 or 40 degrees off center to one another. So they had three sticking out of the back of Dawn. But they weren't designed to fire at the same time. One could fire, and it would actually change its direction a little bit. The other one could fire, the same thing. And they were actually backups. Really, all they needed was one. Put three on board. So it turned out very successful. We're going to miss Dawn. It was a great mission. Another one has just been approved. I don't even have the actual pictures of what this one would look like. This is called Lucy. And Lucy's going to have, I believe, a combination of, it's going to have ion engines, but it might be a combination of SEP engines and also maybe nuclear, because it's going out to near Jupiter. It's going to go into the Trojan area. It's a set of Trojan asteroids involved with Jupiter. One leading before it as it goes around the sun, and one trailing another group. And Lucy plans on visiting both groups. So plans on going out to one, looking at all the stuff that they want to see. They've got a couple of asteroids in mind. And then eventually we'll go to the other group by actually crossing the whole solar system, going to the opposite side of the solar system, from one location in space past the sun to pop out at the beginning of the Trojan area. They'll go to what they call L5, Lagrange point 5, and first, and then leave the deorbit, go past the sun, and then years later, it might reemerge in the same orbit of Jupiter again, but go to the L4, Lagrange point 4, and visit those asteroids. It was just on paper, but now they finally have it approved, where they said that they'll be able to actually start putting this thing together eventually. So don't have an idea of what kind of equipment they're going to have on board. They usually have, 7, 8, 10 instruments on board these things. And we'll have to see. It's a long way off before it gets to where it's got to go. But they plan on launching it only a couple of years from now, 2021. That'll probably have ion engines, SEP ion engines, which are solar-powered, solar-electric-powered engines. They call them SEPs. But they might have a nuclear component as well, I think. I don't know. It's still under development. So that's it. Any further comments? I don't know if you got that picture, Dick, on the InSight mission with patch antennas, but I've come to the end of the line. This is WS2M.
Very fine, Paul. I've got a series of questions on two separate subjects. But first, the expandable, the blow-up of the International Space Station. That's a beautiful diagram. Boy, that shows us the zillions of modules and how they all lay out and expand and so on when they're exploded, so to speak. Very well done, the diagram. And so I imagine if I go to the root of that URL, I'll find other portions where it probably gives some word descriptions of some of those things. The second thing you mailed me on the patch antenna, you told me you're mailing me a URL of patch antenna. The URL is not there, Paul. You told me there is one, but inside of the thing you mailed to me, there is nothing I can go to. Back to you on that one now, Paul.
ATQGS?
It's Roy to the bottom of it. No, I just sent the actual picture. I hear Roy.
Yeah, I got the JPEG loaded. I found actually what I thought was a nicer picture that I'll put up on my website. It's not a diagram. It's an actual photograph of that area exposed.
That would be better. Yeah, this I copied a while back. All I did was just copy it from my computer and send it to you and Dick. Dick, it sounds like he's got a better one.
Okay. I had to use another way of expanding the picture, and there it is. And the patch antenna, is that about 8 of them in a circle? Go ahead.
Yes, that's correct. I think the diameter of the body is probably around 7.5 feet of the lander itself. And it gives you an idea of the closeness of those antennas, the diameter from one end to the other. I bet you it can't be more than 3 or 4 feet.
Yeah, the way those patch antennas are laid out, they're not going to couple very much to each other, Paul. They tend to radiate broadside. So off the edge, there's a null in the pattern off the edge. When you go to the chapter in the antenna engineering handbook on patch antennas where they show you the antenna pattern of one of these, parallel to the sheet of metal, there's almost no signal. It's not a deep null, but pretty close to a null. So if those guys are on slightly different frequencies, if they got the right kind of circulators, if they got the right kind of filters, there's all kinds of ways that they can work independently or as a phased array. Before we end, I'd like to pose some questions with reference to the planets that have been discovered by Kepler. Back to you, Paul. KQIW.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
But before I do, Roy, I wanted to say something to us. Go ahead, Roy.
No, Dick, I already said what I had to say. I posted all the links, so if the people are curious, they go to roy.ac2gs.com. And it has a very nice picture of the InSight vehicle with the cover off, and you can see all the arrays.
Sounds very good. Now, I'm going to go through a little bit of quick history of exoplanet search. For quite a number of years, Barnard Star, a bunch of smart astronomers, were looking at Barnard Star and trying to find extremely minor wobbles because they believed there had to be a planet around Barnard Star. And I think at that time they were not very successful at finding the wobble and confirming it, or at least not getting good solid results. And then one of the very first exoplanets was around 1996, which I think was found by the wobble method. But let me show you the shift of our thinking back with the, what's the name of the Dawn equation now, that predicts the number of life in space.
Drake.
The Drake equation. Back in the early days of the Drake equation, let me drop it. By some magic means, because we hadn't seen any planets around any stars, we assumed planets were real. And people who wanted to be pessimistic said as low as one star per million has planets. We used to believe that. Along comes Kepler, and now we've got thousands and thousands of planets we've discovered. So all of a sudden now, it's the opposite situation. We're absolutely positive there are a lot more planets than there are stars. There used to be one per million, and now we've got, let me pick a number, 10 planets per average star might be the number. Okay. And as we study those planets, my goodness, they range from DC to light. I mean, huge gas planets. Let me drop. Everything from as big as huge gas planets are on the threshold of becoming a star, all the way down to tiny little things going around red dwarf stars and whatever. So we got huge differences in planet size, huge differences in planet compositions, what are they made out of, huge differences in their temperatures and where they're located. So when it comes to Earth-like planets, we used to think that a planet at all would be a rare thing, one per million. Well, now we're looking for Earth-like planets, and they are a bit rare. Because the size of an Earth planet is down at the end of the scale where there's not as many of them with the current methods of detection. But now, here's the funny thing. The majority of the planets we've discovered now are either because they blink the star, in other words, they're occulting the star and we see a little bit of change in the brilliance of the sunlight. If the star happens to go directly, if the planet happens to go directly in front of the star in our direction, which maybe only 1 per 100 or 1 per 50 actually does that. The majority of them are orbiting in some other plane where they don't cast a shadow in our direction and we don't see it. So there's a hell of a lot of planets are there that we're not seeing. The majority of the planets are there we're not seeing. Let me drop them. So again, the total of planets we now know is a huge number. However, because we're finding them by the wobble of a star, a few of them we find that way. The majority of them are by the occulting experiment. That's the majority of them we find that way. But we're finding stars, planets that are occulting a single star. Our particular sun is a unary star. The majority of stars out there are binaries. The current method of detecting, looking for the occulting, is not set up to look for planets going around binary stars. Now, there's at least three ways the planet can go around the binary star. Let me drop. The binary stars going around each other could be so far apart that each individual star has near-in planets around that particular star. And we used to think that wouldn't be stable, but I think we found a few of those. Another way that the planet can go around the star, it can look at the binary pair of stars as one mass center and goes around the outside of the whole thing. So there's a lot of stars out there that we haven't seen because there are more binaries and we're not really looking for planets going around binaries. So as I see it, Kepler did a beautiful job, Kepler 1, Kepler 2. Tess and Gaia are going to drastically add to that. We're going to find more and more stars. But what's your feeling on the subject of planets around binaries, and are we properly looking at the results that we would detect those? WS2N, KQRIW.
There is a planet that was discovered going around two stars, and I don't know which telescope it was that did that. I don't know if it was Kepler, Gaia, or maybe even TESS. So it made a reference to that. I'll have to search it. There is at least one that was discovered like that. That should be interesting. You said Barnard star. Is that one of the ones that you said they're looking at? I think that's one of the close-in ones. I mean, there was a whole series of the Wolf 359, Barnard, a whole bunch of them. I think that's like probably like the fifth or sixth closest star or something to us.
Way back in the 80s and early 90s, they pronounced it Barnard star, and they were looking for wobble of Barnard. Because it was so close, they thought they would be able to detect the wobble easily. And the methods they were using then were nowhere near as accurate as we got today. They weren't doing it by Doppler. They were doing it by looking at the apparent position against the background. And that's a very difficult method of getting enough wobble that you can easily detect, if you know what I mean. So they weren't very successful with that, but I guess Barnard star is being looked at again now with the more modern techniques. And so there really was something there to be detected, but they weren't sure about it. But as I see it, the total number of planets is going to go up by huge numbers with these newer techniques that are being used to search for exoplanets. And I've got a gut feel that we're going to find a hell of a lot more than we anticipate planets around binaries. Now, for planets to be in stable orbits of long duration around binaries, we may find that that's a little bit rare, unless the binaries happen to be very far apart or very close together, and the planet then goes around the pair as a single mass center, or goes around the individual stars because they're so far apart as a binary. And obvious by the fact that we're finding binary black holes, there's got to be a hell of a lot of, well, there's more binary stars than unaries, so there's a lot more planets to be discovered, I think. Back to you, Paul, KQRIW.
Wouldn't it be something if they found one going in a figure eight pattern around binary stars? That would be interesting. You know, similar to what Apollo 13 did, you know, went around the moon. Theoretically, it'd be hard to keep something like that stable, but theoretically it would be possible to have a planet going around in a figure eight type of fashion. The wobble method, that's the Doppler effect. They were using that in the beginning. That's how they found their first exoplanet back in the 90s. And it wasn't a regular star, it was a pulsar. Pulsar, I don't know, 12 something or other. They have this number of nomenclature systems attached to it. I think the year is involved. So it was around pulsar, and they found two or three planets going around that. And that was a big thing. This guy Marcy, his name was Marcy, came out of California. The first one to do it. And then eventually they realized the Kepler system was going to be a much better more efficient, more accurate way of doing it. Although they say it's only good within, I think, 3 or 4 degrees. If the planet is more than 1 or 3 or 4 degrees out of our ecliptic looking range, or not necessarily ecliptic, but looking at it at the star straight on, then you want to see the planet.
And you can work out the mathematics of that, the geometry of that, by looking, make believe you're looking at a very far distance from our sun. Our sun is roughly 950,000 miles in diameter. Earth is something like 8,000 miles in diameter, 93 million miles spaced. And so if you're at an infinite distance, the plane of our orbit around the sun, how far could that plane be tilted where it no longer would cast a shadow as an eclipse from that infinite distance? And it's something like 2 or 3 degrees. So within 2 or 3 degrees, the plane of orbit at our size sun and our distance has to be, in order to be detectable as an eclipsing planet across that sun. If 3 degrees can be detected, that means 87 degrees of tilt cannot be detected. And I guess it's both plus 87 and minus 87. So the vast majority of planets going around the sun, by all the detecting techniques we've used up till now, we're not going to find them. Well, by Doppler, you would still find it. By wobble, you're not going to find anything, per se, at any real distance. And by eclipsing, it's got to be within 2 or 3 degrees, depending on the spacings of the planet and the size of the star and the planet. So there's an awful lot of planets we haven't detected yet. We're seeing, I think the number of planets we're detecting is at least 100 times bigger than anybody expected 20 years ago. Maybe even 1,000 times bigger. And yet we've only seen, let me pick a number, 3% of the ones that are there, Paul. 3US2N, K2RIW.
All right. If you got 90 degrees from the northern part to the equator of every sun, you only see 3. Yeah, that's got to be, yeah, maybe there's 60 or 80 times the amount of planets out there than we'll find using this method. So let's say a few years from now, after tests starts racking up planets, you come up with, say, 10,000 planets, you might find out you really have 60,000 planets that you, well, you know, by half knowing that they're there, that we just can't see because of the inclination.
VDH with a comet.
Now, our VDH recognized, it's now backwards, Paul. And 30 years ago, we thought a planet going around a star is 1 per million. Now, every star has got some large number of planets. There's more planets than there are stars. Now, we can ask the inverse question. Are there any stars out there with no planets? Maybe the answer is no. VDH, you got it, John.
Yeah, I was just wondering about the your comment about a stable orbit around a binary star. Wouldn't in the long term most of those orbits be unstable unless it was very far away from a common point of with the barycenter of where the two stars are orbiting? Go ahead.
Yeah, every binary star system has an elliptical set of orbits. And how big is the ellipse? In other words, what's the eccentricity? That's one of the factors. When a planet is relatively close to a star, like the moon is very close to the Earth, you get what's called tidal locking. You eventually get one single face of the planet, of the satellite aiming toward the planet, or the planet aiming toward the star. So even though there are various kinds of instabilities, I think some of the locking mechanisms will allow certain key parameters to be stable. In the case of what Paul asked earlier, let me drop. Could you have a figure eight orbit around two stars? Like we did a figure eight orbit around Earth and the Moon during the Apollo mission. And I think the answer is making that stable would be very difficult, because minor changes in the way that figure eight is made It's going to make one lobe of the figure eight get big and the other one get small, and you eventually smash into one of those objects. That's my guess as to what can easily happen. So figure eight, I think, is the least possible stable. But various elliptical orbits around the pair with tidal locking, I think there are some certain degrees of orbital sizes, I think, could be made stable. And I'd like to believe there's some smart guys out there doing computer modeling to prove that, because once you admit that there are more binaries than there are unaries, there's got to be planets going around those binaries. In fact, we've already detected a very small number of planets going around the binaries. I wonder how they did that. Do you know how they did that stuff, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
I'm not positive that they did it. I think I remember reading that fine one. They were comparing it to some Star Wars type of show that apparently has that. They found one. But I don't remember the details. They must have walked away from that story. So I can't confirm that, but I'll go look.
Hold on now.
Centauri star system. Go ahead.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Alpha Centauri, I think, is now not a binary. I think it's a trinary. I think they've got three separate objects. The closest possible star to us has already three objects going around each other. We're about to lose the time. This was Technet number 1721. That was Space Report number 321, I believe. And that was Science Report number 50. And so if we've got any time left over before the machine kills us, we'll try to carry on another couple of minutes. Well done, you guys. Over to you, Roy, for any final comments and to give us those websites one more time. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. Once again, for email, any questions, comments, suggestions, what have you, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. In order to get a look at some of the pictures mentioned tonight and links to the articles that some of the reports were based on, it's roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. And if you're interested in the puzzles that Dick mentioned, you can find them by typing in puzzle.ac2rc.com. And if anyone's curious, look up, Google the word three-body problem, which is what a binary star and a planet would encumber. And it's really, really complex math.
I think those are so-called transcendental equations. In other words, no simple solution to them, no fixed-value solution. Okay, thank you an awful lot, Roy. Looking forward to next week. And Paul, we've got to look at the planets around binaries. I think they're there, more than we know about. WS2N, thank you. Bye-bye. Back to you. Final, Paul.
Very good. We'll see you next week, 73. I know we're running out of time. And thanks to Eric for setting up the machine properly for the daylight savings time. WS2N, clear.
The quick look you did at three-body problem, Roy, you came to the conclusion it's very, very complicated. But did they specifically say there are no solutions, or just it's hard to find the solution? Back to you, Roy, if we got some time.
Yeah, sure, Dick. Well, there are restricted versions that are solvable, such as Lagrange points, where one of the masses is incredibly smaller than the other two. But in non-restrictive three-body mathematics, it's unsolvable. Every so often I'll see it on YouTube. They'll have this interesting multi-jointed arm that swings around, and the pattern that it makes is chaotic.
Okay, Lagrange points can be very stable, obvious by the so-called asteroids we've got between Jupiter and Mars. And as long as the third object is small enough, well, a planet can easily be smaller than those two stars that are in Lagrange relationship. So I think there's a lot of small planets out there around binaries. That's my guess. We haven't been using the detecting up till now. We haven't used the detecting technique that can find them. K2RW, are you listening?
I hope as you do that they find them. The more information is always the better.
You'd never believe they're there if you didn't go looking for them. There must be a whole lot of philosophical statements along those lines.
Curiosity is a very important motivating force. It certainly motivates me.
You have to make a leap of faith that they could possibly exist, then you'll find them.
It's kind of dangerous when you start to invoke faith isn't based on any information, but okay.
It's just a gut feel.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.